when I was growing up, my parents recorded
our family, well, me and my sister and the grandparents
once a year, every year.
So I've got myself recorded from the age of naught to, I think we, it kind of came a bit sporadic after sort of 13 when we kind of didn't want to do it anymore. I remember listening back for the first time in years, and between that time and recording, my granddad had died. And I remember not really thinking about it, but just like finding the tape, and it was one tape. Just like in a time now where we just back everything up and all that, I can't believe it was just like for years it was just one tape, you know, with like 15, 16, 17 years of recording on. But I remember listening back and then suddenly my granddad started talking. It just like turned my stomach because I just wasn't expecting it, and I really think it kind of shifted in my focus to kind of what sound, how sound differed. You know, how essentially when it's recorded and played back, it still exists in time and space. Yes, it takes on qualities and character of the recording medium, and yes, it takes on the qualities and character of the thing it's being played back through and the space it's being played in. But if you kind of like don't deal with those specifics, you take the basic principle. When I heard that recording back, for that split second, he was there. And I don't mean in a kind of religious or even spiritual sense. It was just that phenomenon of that experience evoked something. It was such a shift in kind of thinking for me. It was kind of really important. And then it was just such a gem of a document to have, to kind of hear my existence, to hear how I sounded at 1 year old, 2 years old, 3 years old.
This is the first episode of the Domestic Soundscape podcast series commissioned by Sound and Music for the 2009 Cut and Splice Festival, Living Rooms. This year's Cut and Splice Festival is all about everyday places, home, and the ordinary. For many people, tape was involved in their first recording experiences.
Should I put me on now? Me on. A tape. Big tape recorder. Come on. Please put it back on.
It's on now. It's recording what you're saying.
Today I'm focusing on what tape signifies, about its historic use in home recording, and about how artists use tape now for collecting sounds and in other ways where tape's used as a physical material or a context in itself. Mark Vernon has been collecting old tapes and working with found sounds for over 10 years now. I travelled to Glasgow to meet with him and talk about tape clubs.
That is some of the archive, the Derby tape club ones. I just got them at a car boot sale in Derby. It's only when I got it home and started kind of looking through them and kind of reading some of the titles on. You know, it just became apparent that they all belonged to this man, Bill Howard, who was a member of the Derby Tape Recording Club.
And join the Derby Tape Recording Club. For further particulars, contact Mr. A. Hand at telephone 49513.
This isn't just represent, like, it's not just a collection of sounds. It's almost like it's representative of a whole kind of community approach to sound.
Yes, and you know, very individualistic approaches to sound as well. I mean, that's the thing. Particularly Bill Howard from the Derby Tape Club, those first tapes I found. His enthusiasm for sound really comes across as well. You just get the impression he took his tape recorder everywhere with him. When this kind of technology became readily accessible, some people in the clubs didn't have their own tape recorders. They would just group together, or the club would buy a tape recorder. And a lot of the things that they wanted to do, more experimental things, required several tape recorders for dubbing and overdubbing things, and even for making the first stereo recordings as well. They kind of managed to do that with two mono recorders.
I've now got two microphones here, giving me total access to either the right or left-hand channels. I'm now moving into a central position. You realise now that I can either make my voice appear to come from the right or from the left.
There's all sorts. There's recordings of family holidays, letters on tapes from relatives abroad. I mean, with the Leicester Tape Club, the very first meeting, there's like recording of the first meeting and all greeting tapes that were recorded from different clubs around the country to be played at their meeting.
So there was a huge amount of correspondence involved.
Yeah.
Between the different tape clubs.
Yeah, I mean, there was the British Federation of Tape Recording Clubs, and there was a kind of Midlands kind of based organisation as well, because all of the clubs that I've documented so far have been in the Midlands, Nottingham, Leicester, Derby.
As an artist approaching a material like this, I mean, where do you even start, or how do you think about? Because it's not just that you've got a really interesting collection of sounds, there's a huge context to work with there of people's home recordings or their...
I kind of just learnt on the job, really. My approach developed as I was going through the material, almost, really.
I'll tell you about this house. We just rent the top part, and we have the use of the garden or anything like that, and a patio where we can barbecue on and so on. But I'll stop now and then...
Stop!
Yeah, I'll stop.
Go on, then.
All right, we're on again. Go on then, Christine, say something. Go on, tell us.
Shall I recite?
There's one of Bill Howard's, I think it's his brother-in-law, who is stationed in Germany. He's in the RAF or something, I don't know exactly where he was based. But it's a kind of letter on tape that he sent to him. And there's him and his wife and their little boy Duke, kind of all kind of speaking, taking it in turns to speak on the tape. But it's really natural the way it's done. I mean, he's playing music in the background. I think he's kind of playing Mantovani records, and they're just kind of talking. And it's the kind of thing when you're listening to, because a lot of the time I'd just be going through these tapes late at night, and so much of it was nothing. You know, there were blank tapes, and there might just be a little bit somewhere in the middle, you know, just randomly recorded. Or there'd just be music, hours and hours of music. But because you didn't know when a recording would appear or when anything was there, you just go through them. So those moments were really precious when you did discover them. Sometimes you can't quite believe what you're hearing, kind of, you know. You just let, suddenly kind of transported into somebody else's living room from 30 years ago.
So they've obviously just chucked some music on in the background, and then...
I mean, he does that a lot, that chap Duke. He's very natural with the tape recorder. He's just, you know, he kind of puts it on and then just kind of just gets on, and, you know, you hear him kind of moving around the room. It's really nice when you have that sense of the space as well, when he moves away, and then all of a sudden he's very close to the microphone talking into it. I mean, it's funny because I think when I started listening to these tapes as well, I realised that it's just exactly what I do now. That's what these people were doing back then. I mean, obviously with different equipment and, you know, things have changed, the world's changed since then, but it's essentially the same thing, you know. They're just exploring an interest in sound.
And how long do they play for then, Bill?
What, the matter is?
No, this fall, how long on one track, you know?
Well, it depends on your speed. But,
well, have you got two speeds?
Yeah.
Oh, what's
on this
now?
On 3.5 now, 3.75.
Oh, I see.
So naturally, if you go on your 1 7/8.
Well, yeah, but let me see, what size ball? 3 inch or 4 inch?
Yeah, 3 inch.
That'll be about what? 12 minutes? Is it long play tape, or...?
It'll be about 15 minutes on 3.75, wouldn't it?
Is it long play?
No, it's just cheap. It's a cheap one. You can stop it.
So that's actually Duke Manners, who was on that other tape with the little boy, and Bill Howard, who he's sending the tape to. That's one of the few recordings I've got of them actually together, kind of speaking. And I think he's taken him along to one of the Derby Tape Club meetings.
The sense of a community approach to recording that Mark describes when he talks about tape clubs is echoed in the phonostatic cassettes, which were cassette compilations made to accompany the photostatic scene. I interviewed Lloyd Dunn about this venture to get more of a sense of how tape, community and home recording collided in this exciting corner of 1980s culture.
Over a period of 5 or 6 years, I developed this sort of following in the zine community, which was in the late 80s was pretty big. Actually, there were thousands of zines coming out at a certain point. And many of the people in the zine community were interested in smashing boundaries. And so there were a lot of graphic artists that were experimenting with tape and video and all sorts of different media and treating media itself as a medium as opposed to putting things into individual, you know, categorizations. So a lot of the people who submitted to the Phonoesthetic cassettes were either zine producers or zine followers, and some of them were graphic artists more than they were sound artists, but you know, they just had this real eagerness to experiment with just anything they could lay their hands on. By and large, the trend was to work with inexpensive, low-tech equipment and try to just make it be as, use it expressively and inventively and creatively as possible. Try to reverse the widespread public perception that one needed to have a huge budget and a really nice studio and an expensive producer in order to actually produce music. We wanted to sort of like challenge that.
This is the end of Phonoesthetic Side 1. Please flip the tape over. Some rewinding may be necessary.
The choice of tool, analog tape, very strongly determined the final form of the pieces, I would say.
It doesn't matter very much.
We sort of really enjoyed the mistakes. We encouraged the machines to not break but malfunction in interesting ways. We really sort of appreciated the sense that, in some sense, we were collaborating with the machines. The machines actually seem to have minds of their own sometimes.
130 to 136.
That story's replacement will not mean total chaos.
1260.
Yesterday will not judge admission.
You know, most of us, I suspect, well, at least was the case for me, we were working to liberate home stereo equipment. We were just basically using cassette players as, and trying to reverse their function as, you know, receivers of culture and turn them into producers of culture, if you will.
The Phonoestatic releases are interesting in terms of the domestic soundscape because they deal with the idea of the sounds we consume within the home. The desire to alter, author, or rearrange the sounds and broadcasts often heard at home is very present. News reports are cut up and reordered.
17, just press a button.
457 to 474.
How's that?
127 to 140.
Recordings of domestic objects like the telephone are used as the basis for compositions. And private accounts are juxtaposed next to experimental cut and splice tape works.
Yeah, okay. Are these all the onions? Well, it doesn't seem like much, but then
the idea of editing things together in interesting ways is an idea that seems to have its origins in both the mistakes made while recording on tape and the physical manipulation of tape.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm only on for 3 minutes. Well, I haven't had time to do a drama or anything like that, but I have become very interested in electronics. And apparently, by putting a few funny noises together and trimming them up, you can make a tune. I'll just give you some examples what I mean. Number one, coming up. Samples of electronic noises. Now then, by getting a pair of scissors and snipping a piece off here and pulling a piece out there and then putting them all together, you can get a tune something like this. ¶¶ see what I mean. Cheerio, my time.
We set about to make a series of cassette tape loops. So we would unscrew cassette shells and pull out a bit of tape from a project we were working on and make it just a perfectly length loop and drop it into the cassette, screw this shell back together, and then put it in the cassette player and just listen to it and flip it over and collecting interesting loops that way. And so I think this is probably just an assemblage of a couple of different loops played in different tracks.
In talking to people during the research for this podcast, I found a prevalent desire to work with the limitations and physicality of tape. I've not made a perfectly looped tape by hand, unscrewed a cassette, or chopped up a track and stuck it back together, but I did spend hours and hours recording mixtapes as a teenager, and I recall that as a very manual experience, and perhaps my first contact with the idea that sound can be used to make meaning.
It speaks to a universal drive for people who want to like create their own cultural experience, even if they're just using the finished works of other people. They still want to assemble it in their own way and sort of offer it up to other people and share it. So this impulse is very strong.
The materiality and context of the mixtape are key ideas for Rachel Matthews, who spun people's cassette tapes into yarns during a project called Analog Amnesty.
I learnt to spin, and learning to spin, if anyone's ever done it, it takes ages. You can learn the concept of it in like an hour, but it's just practice. It's the dexterity that you need, and so you need to lock yourself away for ages and just keep practicing. And at that time, I was getting out all my old mixtapes. It was then that I saw how close the spinning wheel and the tape recorder are, because they're both analog. And just this idea of like the freedom of when you're spinning, you can mix any colours and you can make exactly the right yarn you want. And it seemed really similar to that thing of locking myself in my bedroom and making mixtapes, because you can make a whole fabric with a mixtape. With the spinning wheel, I could shove in all these sort of colours and textures and feelings into the yarn. And it's the same thing where I was making the mixtape and making the mixtape as a whole, as like a mixtape could either be an event or it could be a story or it could be a selection of feelings. And the yarn can be a bit the same, but it's the long process of moving a wheel. It's very similar to the mixtape.
And there's a time relationship with it as well, where it goes through the machine and it takes... If it's a minute of sound, that takes a minute for the tape to go through it. And I find that, like, I mean, with kind of, like, with a CD or even with my digital recorder, I have a completely different relationship with time. In a tape, you can't remove time from the medium.
No. You can't edit it in the same way. You can't just take a bit out of the middle. And it's the same with, like, knitting something. You can't go back and take a bit out that you'd done before. I mean, you could do, but you'd have to redo the whole thing. I think that kind of patience with that real time is something that's easily lost.
Did you find that the physical object of the tape that somebody would give you would give you ideas about what you would do with the yarn?
Yeah, sometimes the covers do, definitely, if someone's made a handmade cover. Or the names of the tapes, like the names that we give tapes are really peculiar. Like, I had a mixtape called Hippie Tape, which was given to me when I was about 14 by a guy who was a bit older than me at school. It's actually just a load of songs from the 60s, but he had this idea that that's what hippies were. I mean, it's not what I would call hippie music, but he thought it was. And then you can make a yarn out of that, which is kind of what you'd think hippies were, which is kind of multicoloured and a bit lumpy with bits of straw in it, that sort of thing.
I've been thinking about tape loads recently, obviously, with making the podcast. I've been thinking a lot about tape. What's occurred to me is that I really remember the physical objects of tapes I've owned. I really remember them, and I remember the names and the stickers and everything. I don't have the same relationship with CDs.
No.
I don't remember any CDs. And even though it's an object and it comes and it's in a box and it's got a label and everything, I don't know, do you think that the difference is that when you record a mixed CD, you don't have to you don't physically handle the tape in the same way.
You don't touch it. But there's the other thing where, like, most mixtapes have a fault in them. Like, when you're making a mixtape, you have to rewind everything to the right place and you have to get the levels right, and there's so much that could go wrong. And there was quite a skill in it. And a lot of tapes that I've got now, I can see there's something wrong. And then you put a song in that really annoys you in the middle of it, and you've got to go through with that because you could fast forward it a bit if you wanted to, but so you've got to live with all these bad things, and that's what makes them really real, because that's what life is like. You have to live with things that you don't really like. It's like having a relationship or a job. There's always bits that you don't like, and it's the same with knitting and spinning. There's bits that go well and there's bits that you don't like, and you just have to sort of get on and just live with them, really, or make the most of them, or try and appreciate them. But with a CD, if you don't like something, you can go, oh, that didn't work, I better delete that one. Or you can import someone's mixed CD onto your computer and delete the bits that you don't like. So you never get to have to live with the thing as a whole. And I think it was that making of the mixtape as a whole that you were making like a whole concept. And it's the same thing with spinning a yarn and knitting a whole jumper. It's a whole lot of work. And you kind of think that it's going to last, don't you?
I love what Rachel said about how, with a mixtape, you have to live with difficult tracks and bits you don't really like, as well as your favourite songs. This reminds me of the domestic soundscape and everyday reality, because you always have to deal with unwanted stuff when working in these contexts. Stuff you'd rather delete or skip over but can't.
What's happened to the voices?
It's just
in
on
that?
The wrong speed. Oh, unfortunately, right. I can't play it on 7.5 inches per second because it just makes a horrendous noise. I'll demonstrate. Oh. But
another artist who has worked with the limitations of tape in a very interesting way is Joya T. Wiley, whose performance answerphone piece uses the specific qualities of an old answerphone and a new cell phone to dialogue with art history.
I've actually been asked to make a response to Jim Allen's work as a performance. They re-exhibited a show of his that had been shown in 1975 in 2007, so over 30 years later. And they asked me to do a performance in response to that show. I was born in 1975, so it was kind of like even second generation artist responding to this work made in the 70s. And we all know about that, the sort of the 70s performance, you know. I'm quite fascinated with that. So I was actually really pleased to be asked to do it. And one of the videos is a part of a trilogy called Contact. The actual piece was called Computer Dance. That was the work that touched me the most, that I sort of felt that I could work with and that I really liked the most. So I decided I would sit in front of that and actually create a new sound work for that piece. I got them to turn the sound off and did my own sound for it live with the answer phone and a cell phone. So I connected the answer phone up to the gallery's phone number and then called it on my mobile phone. It's a really old answer phone, like probably over 20 years old. It's sort of half broken and, you know, the cord doesn't go in properly, so it has to be gaffer taped together, but I liked all that about it. It sort of worked well with the video work and the fact that I was doing something 30 years later, sort of having the answer phone and then the cell phone talking to each other. When I called the cell phone, obviously there's quite a big speaker box on the old black answer phone. So when I called the answer phone with the cell phone, it created this fantastic feedback. And the piece, Computer Dance, that he did, the video performance, was basically about five couples, men and women, who had little speakers attached to them, stuck on their bodies, and they were holding little infrared torches. They were also wearing masks. and they were walking around this constructed environment trying to find the other man or woman. And when they did, the feedback would go off and there'd be sort of a high-pitched sound. And I really liked that concept, and I really enjoy feedback too. So I decided to do that with the telephones and sound. And that was the basis for my idea, was to have some kind of response, so an answer, and some kind of feedback to recreate my version of the sound. So those were the two main reasons that I chose to use the answer phone. I didn't just do this piece live as a once-off. I actually spent a couple of weeks at home, ringing myself at home and practicing it. Really enjoyed that cutoff, because the answer phone only records about a minute and then it cuts off. If the sound stops, it then cuts off as well. So you get this quite jarring sense, especially if I was in the middle of something where it felt that it was getting to a climax, or you hear the next word. It was kind of like, oh. And when it first went off in the gallery, people were looking worried, like they thought it might have been a mistake. And that was quite good as well, because obviously everyone was slightly nervous and a little bit baffled. And that was one of the things that Jim Allen really loved and tried to create in his work too. It would stop, and because it was such an old answer phone, it would sort of clunk, you know, and there'd all be all these things that you had to wait for the message, yes, you're right, to rewind, and then I'd have to ring it again. So there was this pause that was quite a pregnant pause until it could resume again.
This piece is in response to Jim Allen's work. Always and never, a completed portrait of some woman. Where are your poems? Are they under? Where are they? Are they? Where are they? Ana Akmatova, are they? Are your poems under? Your poems under Akmatova, are they? Where are they? Where? Are they under? Are they? Are they under? Under? Are they? Where are they? Akhmatova. Are they? Akhmatova. Where? Akhmatova. Are they under? Where? Where? Where?
I love the sense of communication in Answer Phone piece, a conversation between old and new technologies and between contemporary and historic art forms. Like a mixtape, a telephone call or an answer phone message can be an intimate communication in sound.
I've always been fascinated by the telephone. I can't really say why. I just think the telephone is just this amazing thing. You pick it up and you can hear someone talk from far away, you know, could be on the other side of the world even. And it's like you're in the same space, but you're not in the same space. And of all the appliances in the house, it's probably the closest to being, you know, to having some sort of intimacy with you, because you're actually speaking to someone that maybe you love, you know, or maybe you care about, or some family member. So there's this sort of intimacy level to dealing with the telephone.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and try again. If you need help, you'd like to make a call.
Joyety's piece and Lloyd Dunn's description of the allure of the telephone remind me of how sound can take you to another place. I made a tape from my favourite radio show years ago in Ireland. I used to forget I was recording, and all these bits of unwanted radio ended up on the tape. More recently, these undesirable intrusions became the best thing about the tape because they transported me back to my former life whenever I listened through. I played this tape constantly for over a year, fascinated by the weirdly sequenced mix of news, adverts, tracks, and out-of-date cultural announcements. Rachel then spun the tape into a yarn for me, and I knit headphones out of that yarn and played the story of the tape through them at an exhibition in February this year called Love is Awesome. I interviewed my knitting group about those headphones and was really surprised at how resonant the idea of memory and tape was for other people.
The pair of headphones with the tape woven in, speaking about mixtapes, I can really relate to that whole mixtape era, I really, really can. But also I find it makes me think back to when I was in my early 20s. Well, not that, I mean, I'm only in my late 20s now, but it does seem like an age away, and especially music of that time is so evocative. And also I feel a real sense of, like, as the talk goes on about how the tape is actually woven in, I become really aware of the headphones on my head, and I think it was a real commitment to not record that tape before it went into the yarn. I think it now exists as this fantastic epitaph, you know, to this tape. I've listened to that piece now about 4 or 5 times. It just, from what it brings out for me in terms of memory and things that are lost but things that are really present at the same time. There's a real sadness to memory, I think.
And it just reminded me so much of when I was a lot younger and people make mixtapes, you know, that sort of pledge of love thing, have a mixtape, and it's just got that kind of rubbish on it, and you can never hear the things you really want to hear. It made me laugh a lot. While my ears were keeping warm.
Yeah, I remember having tapes myself in the past where I was recording off the radio, and you kind of get bits of speech left because you hadn't pressed the button.
Yes. Because that's when it used to be, the old push button.
Oh, yes.
Little tape deck things.
Play and record.
The mixtape is obviously used most often for music compilations, but the means of recording and sharing sounds are the same whether you're sharing pop tunes or environmental noises. In Back in Analog Land, Aki Onda talks about his recording process with tape. In Cassette Memories, he describes how his recordings are like personal memories or a sound diary of events. His CD, Bon Voyage, is created mostly from unprocessed field recordings made on his Walkman. In the opening sequence of For the Birds, we skip between sonic snapshots, travelling in sound from one environment to another. The means of gathering the material is audible in the recording. We hear the tape stopping and starting, the clicks of the Walkman as it switched on and off. It's been made so that we don't forget the context of the work. A person travelling, listening to things, recording and collecting sounds, keeping memories and diaries. For the Birds is as much about the story of the recordist and his means of collecting sounds as it is about interesting sonic effects. This may be because tape lets us hear those elements, but it's also because Aki Onda doesn't edit them out. Yeah. I found a similar sequential recording full of the sounds of a tape recorder and moving between environments and time in rapid succession.
640.1 at Mrs. 4.
So 25 minutes to 5. Mrs. Souter, having fallen out of the door, eventually let me start her car for her. She's an ex-registered, W-registered. Ford Escort, but they aren't too popular. I don't know. Never seen one.
Last year, mate, it was 80.
This tape belonged to my friend Mel's dad when he was a mechanic.
It was easier for him to record mileage, job details, car parts and hours of labour on a portable dictaphone than on paper because his hands, covered in engine grease from his work, would make written notes illegible. Although the reason for the recording was purely practical, the result has a rhythm about it generated by the systemic methodology, the habits of the recordist and the sounds of the tape machine itself. And talking about it with her dad, Mel got the sense that for all its practical purposes, the tape had been kept because of its value as a record of life being lived.
Cheerio. Hi. It's, what day is it today, Tim? Wednesday? Wednesday, we're after lunch now. 9:07, 9:08. Exactly. Quarter past two. Hi, Mrs. Gale. This morning when we didn't have...
The straightforward and linear nature of tape recording is so obvious in this. Press record, speak, say the time, say where you are, car parts, mileage, hours of labour, stop. There's a tangible relationship between time and material. The start, the middle and the end of recordings are confined physically to a continuous length of tape, to a single track, if you will. Whereas in digital recordings, different tracks can be easily assigned to different sounds, and navigating around material doesn't have to either happen in real time or be straightforwardly back and forwards. Mark Vernon has thought about this relationship between time, sequence and editing, and has started a series of works called Pause Button Portraits.
You know, on a tape, it's one thing after another, after another, after another. Sometimes they're recorded over or kind of chop things off. And I don't know, they're kind of accidental or non-deliberate things, but how you can actually use those or incorporate those into a kind of composition yourself. And that brings me back to the pause button portraits. It's kind of removing that additional level that you could interfere with things by very deliberately just recording one thing after another in a linear fashion. Quite interesting, because it's not a way I normally work at all. You normally record much more and give everything space around it so that you can isolate a sound and it's not going to be encroached upon by anything else. But to kind of edit in that way, it's almost like, you know, kind of press the button, slam a door, press the button again, and then... So sometimes it can be really fast kind of moving between things. I'm just going to people's houses and recording every single sound that I can find, anything that makes a noise, but just with the recorder on in pause mode, just going around from one thing to the next, recording it. That's the edit, you know, for about 5 to 10 minutes. You know, there's no kind of editing afterwards. It's kind of done there on the spot, kind of just by recording one thing after another, and then interviewing the people about their house or their home and how they feel about it and anything that they want to say about it or anecdotes that they have.
Yeah, we've enjoyed living here. We've never, well, the odd occasion we've looked at others just to see if the grass is greener elsewhere, and I think we decided that this is pretty good.
It's a nice area, yeah. Close to shops, on a bus route. Another reason we moved was for the schools, because...
And when you make the pause button recordings, I mean, are you thinking about almost in a musical sense of like, what am I going to do next? Or do you just move through the space as you normally would move through a house and then record things as you encounter them?
A bit of both. Sometimes it's kind of just going from one thing to the next, but at others, particularly when there's similar sounding things, it's kind of a decision whether to group those together or whether to put the space of other things in between them to kind of spread them out a bit. So yeah, I am thinking about different types and different qualities of the sounds and what will sit next to another sound or what won't work so well.
So moving around in the space is as much a sort of part of the composing as recording.
Yeah. And it's nice as well sometimes that distance from the mic or the closeness of the mic and the different sense of space you get from that as well, that's all part of it.
I was curious about this and created a pause button portrait of my own home. This recording approach is rare among mine, since the physical process of recording, the tiny clicks of the pause button as I press it to unpause and pause the recorder, are things I normally remove, out of habit. Thinking about tape has made me question the relationship between editing and authenticity, between my tidy digital edits of domestic space. And accidental, unedited recordings of home spaces captured when a machine was left recording on a sideboard and nobody noticed. I don't want to make too many sentimental claims about tape or get embroiled in a kind of digital versus analogue debate, but domestic recordings will always be associated in some way with tapes and the advent of home recording equipment, because that's their history. A history of objects in the home habitually being used, becoming part of the furniture, and laying the foundations for home recording culture.
My son John went into bed with his trousers.
In April, I put up a query on the Yahoo Phonography group to see if anyone would be interested in participating in a tape-sponding project using a cassette and the postal service. The response was overwhelming, and the tape is still travelling around the UK before heading off to Germany and the US. Each correspondent listens to what has been recorded before and adds 20 seconds of new material to the tape. I put an emphasis on imaginative ideas and domestic spaces in the brief, but beyond that, the idiosyncrasies of different players, the distinctive sonic features of different home stereos, the inevitable mistakes and trace of the recording process, are all desired features of the project. Travelling from home to home, through one pair of hands to the next, accumulating time, recorded materials and wear, the Tapespondence tape is a slow community effort. Organised through the online internet communities that are directly descended from correspondence projects like Phonostatic or the Derby Tape Club, this project could easily have been realised through the use of digital media and file uploads. But as an artist, you have to decide what material you'll use and how that will shape the meaning of your project. And sometimes the slow, messy, mistakeful and difficult to edit material of tape is the only thing that will do. Sometimes, in its physicality and its references, it's just the thing a project needs in order to make sense. Tape is an object with sound directly embedded in it and can be used to say something about sound without being played, as in Rachel Matthews' spun tape yarns or Christian Markley's knitted tape pillow. Tape is the material that gathered and collected a curious generation's first experiments in home recordings. Unlike the record, which is similarly iconic in terms of its material sonic connotations, tape was the medium that widely disseminated the power to record, author and remix the soundscape of our homes. That's why I believe tape is important in our understanding of the domestic soundscape.
Trip. Record the babies, take it upstairs with Mum and team. So all recording as we're talking. Alright? We'll play it back when you're finished.
Full details of the Tapespondence project are available in the show notes. The finished result will be played in the final episode of this podcast. You've been listening to Felicity Ford on the first episode of the Domestic Soundscape podcast series commissioned by Sound and Music. This podcast was created especially for the Cut and Splice Festival 2009, and full show notes, links and images are available on the Cut and Splice website at www.cutandsplice.com. Thank you for listening. Join me again next week, where I'll be looking at rooms and chambers.